This is Class, an official podcast of the Democratic Socialists of America National Political Education Committee. My name is Elton L.K. This is the second episode in a two-part series on the state of the labor movement in 2022 and what we expect in 2023 and why we as socialists care so much about the labor movement. Defna Tir and Ryan Coles are hosting this episode. Defna Tir is the Labor Education Coordinator at the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, also known as EWOC. Ryan Coles is a co-chair on DSA's National Labor Commission. He helps workers build power in their workplace as a volunteer with EWOC and as a member of the Inland Empire DSA.
Welcome to this episode of DSA's National Political Education Podcast, Class. I'm Defna Tir, and I'm hosting this episode along with Ryan Coles, co-chair of DSA's National Labor Committee. We're actually talking about socialists and the class in this two-part series, or socialists in the labor movement. And with us here today, we have Emma G, who's a rank-and-file Teamster UPS package car driver, and another member of DSA's National Labor Steering Committee, and Dawn Teft, who's come out of rank-and-file organizing higher education unions and is now a union staffer and a lead organizer for Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. In our first episode, we took a look at the labor movement last year and the role socialists played in it. And today, we're going to talk about why the labor movement is so important to socialists. Hi, Ryan. Hi, Emma. Hi, Dawn. Really excited to get to talk more about socialists in the labor movement. And first, maybe we can start, why is the working class so important to socialists? Why do we focus on them? Why are we so obsessed with the labor movement? Why them specifically? We talk about the working class having a unique position, a unique power, an ability to change history. What is that power? What's the source of their power? Emma, do you want to try and tackle that one?
Sure, I would love to. Yeah, so I would start off by just clarifying that when we talk about the working class in this particular way, we're talking about it as a strictly in relation to the capitalist class. So I know the word working class often gets thrown around with more like cultural aspects or asking who is working class and who's not. But that's not really what we're talking about when we are talking about the power and leverage of the working class. The working class are the ones with the power because they show up every day to do their jobs. And in doing that, they are the ones making profits for the company or the bosses and only getting paid a wage, so a fraction of the profits that are being made. Without these people, without the working class, without the workers, these profits do not exist. And then when we talk about a strike, the power of a strike comes from withholding that work and costing those companies that wealth. We understand that capitalism is cutthroat, and ultimately companies, they have to prioritize profits above everything else. We call corporations evil, and a lot of the times they are run by people who are not good. But even the nicest person running a company, ultimately, if they want that company to survive, they have to prioritize profits and they have to put the well-being of their workers on the back burner. It doesn't matter. Everything is in service of making that money. So an organized working class is the only group with the power and the interest to twist the arm of the capitalist class by costing them that money, jeopardizing the only thing that they care about, which is those profits. So this is why we strike. No work means the company is losing money. And I'm saying the company, but, you know, capitalists in general. And unlike, I always want to compare a strike to a protest because we're not trying to change hearts and minds of politicians or oppressive forces with a strike. That's when we protest, we are making voices heard. It's important, but a strike is a different relationship. It has material effects and it uses the capitalist system against the capitalists for the workers to win the things that they are demanding, which ultimately, as socialists, we believe we want to win a better world.
I'll just say that, you know, the working class has the power and leverage to change history for multiple reasons, including that they far outnumber the wealthy elite, and they are the ones who make everything function. So they're the reasons that hospitals run. They're the reasons hospitals can treat injuries and illnesses and save lives. You know, they're the reason that schools run. They serve meals to students and teach classes and attend to students' like psychological needs and transport students to and from classes. They're the reason people can obtain food even during a pandemic when it was dangerous to even be next to other people. You know, and without the working class, there are no functioning workplaces and no functioning society. And because they make everything go, everything that exists should exist with their good in mind, as opposed to swelling the offshore bank accounts of billionaires. And the power of a strike is that it makes this all obvious by grinding things to a halt. So if a majority of workers at a work site agree that they'll all withdraw their labor until X thing is won, then they create the kind of problem that employers actually respond to because they have to, for all the reasons that Emma pointed out about, like, this is their main motivator, right? They can't not respond to this.
Yeah, thank you, Don and Emma. And I think you're right, too, where, I mean, if we look at, you know, the recent rail contract, I mean, we can see why the White House stepped in, right? Because that makes it very apparent who keeps things running in this country. And if the railroads shut down, if the workers are out on strike, then things stop moving. And I mean, it would lay bare who actually does the work and who keeps society running and all that good stuff that you talked about. So with that kind of recent example in mind, I'm curious, Don, are there any examples of when strikes have been used as tools for major political reforms? And can they go beyond the bread and butter issues like wages and working conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm in Chicago, so I can talk about what's happening in Chicago and the larger state. So in Chicago, CTU won an elected school board for CPS, which is hugely important because the board that governs the schools for the third largest city in America was previously entirely political appointees. And, you know, who were appointed by politicians who themselves are beholden to corporate interests. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why there was such a big push to create charter schools and privatize public education in Chicago. And Chicago's privatized so much of what used to be considered a public good, such as parking even. And, you know, as a result, the working class is paying more and receiving less. And so CTU pushed for an elected school board. And so the working class could have more voice in their own education. And I consider it a wonderful example of both action and electoral work coming together. They were able to win on this issue because they have 25,000 workers, which is a huge number of voters, and because they did the electoral and public relations work. But they also, you know, were able to so effectively move the city on that and other issues by striking repeatedly. Even though they didn't strike for this issue in particular, their history of striking was, I believe, a factor. So the city and the state both understand that CTU is a powerhouse everywhere, in the voting booths, on the work site, and in the streets, because they're also in the streets for things like the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, they're everywhere and they have power in all those arenas. I'd also point to the fact that Governor Pritzker increased funding for public higher ed. And in higher ed, the trend has just been to defund it. And just 40 years ago, people could go to college for peanuts, because public education was subsidized through tax dollars. And over the decades, that money's been diverted to other areas, allocated towards things like building more prisons, which they then have to put a bunch of people in, and they justify it that way, when it should have been spent on education. You know, but in Illinois, there have been a lot of higher ed strikes over the last several years, including two fairly lengthy strikes by graduate workers at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the University of Illinois at Chicago, both of which completely ground those universities to a halt. Since most classes now are taught by grad workers and or adjuncts, and for those who don't know, adjuncts are people who are forced to work part-time, even though just like 3 or 4 decades ago, they would have been full-time professors. So now they earn like poverty wages and have no job security and usually little to no benefits. The strike at UIC in Chicago was, and I have to point this out as the former staffer for them at the time, it was notably an offensive, not a defensive strike. And I think it's important to point this out because it's important to determine what your bottom lines are for what you need on a few key issues and then say, this is what we need to gain or else we'll strike. Because that's how unions lay the ground for making gains and advancing social justice in general. And I'd point out that that's a social good, right? Increasing the funding for higher ed, which is serving people who don't have, you know, the generational wealth to go to private school. So these are very much working class students. And, you know, a lot of them are people of color. And so just as at CTU, where a majority of the students they're serving are students of color, you know, they're coming from working class backgrounds. And so fighting for these things that we need and striking and taking action to win these things that we're getting at the bargaining table, as well as at the sort of legislative level, is, I think, hugely important and an example of how we can't just rely on like voting to win things, right? We have to be willing to take action. We have to prove how we're strong and create problems that they have to address both on the work site and in the streets.
Yeah, thank you, Dawn. And some of what you touched on there made me think of too, I think it was back in 2021, some longshore workers in the Bay Area, I think in Oakland, they had refused to unload an Israeli operated cargo ship. And so I think that's kind of the example of how we can fight beyond the bread and butter issues, right? But it is important to note the reason they were able to do that is because they have a strong militant rank and file membership. So they were able to use that to fight beyond wages, beyond working conditions for larger social justice. So I think that is a perfect example of how we can go beyond just fighting for better wages. But first, we need to develop that strong militant rank and file base.
Yeah, absolutely. And CTU was for similar reasons, you know, fighting for affordable housing for students in Chicago, because how can you possibly learn in a classroom if you don't have housing, or if you're hungry, you know, if you don't have your basic needs met, if you don't have social services in place and, you know, your family's not earning enough that you can have your belly full, how are you going to learn in the classroom? If you don't have a place to sleep at night, how are you going to learn? And so bargaining for the common good is what it's called, right? Where you're fighting for social services, racial justice, you know, all these things that aren't considered bread and butter issues, but are crucial for the communities in which workers are situated and who they're supposedly serving, right? And so if you're really serving those communities, then you're fighting for those communities too.
This is such an important conversation to be having, because so often our experience in the current political moment is of defeat. So many of the things that we want, we're not getting. And it's so frustrating. And it feels a lot of times like, well, if only, you know, we had enough socialists in office, we had the right kind of socialists in office, the right people, then we would get Medicare for All or the Green New Deal, or we'd win some major reforms. And I think when we look at the state of the labor movement, we have to understand that as being a major issue for us to win anything else. We just don't have the power to make major changes. And that's what you all have been kind of getting at. We talked a lot about in the last episode about 2022 for labor. And what we didn't get around to talking about was the rail workers and their averted strike that didn't lead them down to a good contract. They didn't get the time off that they wanted, which is obscene. Like, it's just, you know, can you imagine not having any time off and working on rail on the railways? That's bad for everybody, not just for those workers, of course. But it was a major question for us as socialists, because the strategy, how to get that paid sick leave and how to make sure workers had a voice and had the power to decide what their contract was, unclear. And I wanted to ask about that. We had electeds, DSA electeds in Congress that voted against the right to strike, basically, by voting for this agreement. And that looked like a major reflection of where things were at, because it seemed like the unions had already sort of sent us down that path. And I think one of the main silver linings for me about that whole railroad workers' experience was seeing what happened in the aftermath when one of the two large unions with 28,000 members, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, they ousted. Here's another reform experience, right? They ousted their president and they voted in Eddie Hall, who is a local officer out of Tucson and spent 28 years working on the railways, and then 12 years as a local leader. And he just seemed to them to not be willing to compromise in the way that the leaderships did. But it is a question for us as socialists, like, what is our role in this?
Yeah, it's tough. And it's like, even as I reflect on it now, it's still a lot of untangling. There's a lot of opinions about what did happen, what should have happened with the rail contract fight, what DSA electeds role should have been. And like, I'll preface all this to noting that even on like DSA Labor, our steering committee, we have differences in opinions on how we should have approached that as DSA, what our response should be or should have been, all of that sort of stuff too. So, I mean, I just want to make clear that I'm speaking for myself here. So yeah, I think we can look back. It was a bad vote, but it never should have come to that, because I think when we look to the labor movement, our power isn't, you know, through simply electing the right people to represent us. It's through actually engaging in struggle. And we talked a little bit about the upcoming contract fight with UPS workers, the big three with UAW. I mean, just right there, that's almost 500,000 union members who are going to be engaged in the struggle in the next year. And those are the sorts of spaces that we will see us able to build and wield power. That's what we need to focus on.
I think it's very hard for a few socialist politicians at the federal level to hold out. And so my emphasis for the time being is on electing socialist politicians at lower levels of office, and just as, if not more importantly, helping workers unionize and take action. So it's really about building the base that holds those politicians accountable, because even the most ethical politicians need to be held accountable and they need to be representing people who have power. So we need to make sure that we're building that power. And I think if we can build our base at these levels, we can have more conversations about like what we need to do to transform the government and economy at the upper levels. Not that they're separate, I mean, they're intricately linked, but we can't skip over that part. And I think that organizations like, for example, United Working Families in Chicago are attempting to do that by uniting labor unions and, you know, electoral work and community orgs. So they're really bringing all these groups together in ways that demonstrate or understand that you can't separate them out. You can't have power without those being united. And I think are probably trying to build a labor party, in essence, or the nucleus of one, or, you know, a model for one.
DSA is small, but we're growing and we punch above our weight too. And the fact that we're having these sort of conversations is indicative of the fact that we are starting to gain power, because now there's real stakes and we need to figure out what we do with that and what we do with this power that we've been building. And I think we need to be self-critical. We need to be intentional in everything that we do. We need to focus not just on tearing the organization apart through criticism, but we also need to look outwards on how we can build power, so how we can continue to increase the stakes and have a say in things. Well, question two, where we can close things out a little bit, is just how do we get to that point where workers are able to strike politically, our electeds are representing them, and what should socialists do to get that right? We got a long fight ahead of us. How do we make that happen? How do we keep moving in that direction to keep building and growing this power that we do have?
Thank you for injecting some positivity in there. It kind of reframed it for me a little bit and reminded me of that. That yeah, we're already building. We need to keep building.
Building up a working class that sees themselves and their organization, either formally within unions or informally in building unions and unionizing, as political, I think is actually a place that we still have to get to in a lot of places. Again, a lot of what I have is anecdotal, but people don't even see that their workplace issues connected to like politics on a national or even local level. So I think that we talked about a lot of contracts coming up in the next year and a lot of opportunity for whether it's strikes or just contract campaigns that are agreed on pre-strike. Those kinds of like collective worker actions, especially strikes, can be really radicalizing. And I think, again, as socialists in the labor movement, we have the opportunity to draw these connections, say like, this is more than just our bread and butter issues here. This is more than just about our workplace. Look, there's a strike happening there. There's a contract campaign happening in that sector. And really drawing the connections, being like, we are all part of the same fight. We are all struggling for better wages, for safer working conditions, because people are busy. They are not always thinking about these kinds of things or paying attention to the news. And like, labor issues are not covered in the way that we would like to see them covered. So really like having those conversations will be huge, and it allows them to feel their power. And like, we want elected officials to see that power, to be afraid of them. Politicians' relationships to unions should not be some kind of like personal cozy relationship with union leadership, which is how it has been with Democrats, the party that's supposed to be on our side for a long time. We just saw what happened with the rail workers. They did not come through in any kind of meaningful way.
as I spoke about earlier, you know, CTUs are bargaining for the common good, to bargain over things like social services that the students need in order to not just survive, but thrive. Because until your survival is ensured, you can't thrive, right? The racism institutionalized in our economic structures means that CTU is, in essence, fighting racist economic policies through their bargaining. And the power that unions like CTU wield at the bargaining table, you know, is directly proportional to the actions that they take, such as striking. We're really going to need to see a lot more strikes in order to win on these issues that are outside of the bread and butter issues, in addition to winning on the bread and butter issues, because we need all of that. We need to create problems in the workplace and in the streets that city and state level politicians have to deal with. For example, Chicago's mayor doesn't want to engage with these issues, but CTU has consistently used action to draw attention to the lack of social services and fight to increase them. And I think that there's a lot that we'll be fighting out or figuring out along the way. From my perspective of somebody who grew up in poverty and has seen the worst effects of our political and economic systems play themselves out in the lives of my immediate family members, you know, I'd say that above all else, all the work that we do geared towards this has to empower the working class. That is absolutely critical to everything that we do. And when I talk about this with workers, I sometimes compare it to the civil rights movement as a sort of, you know, helpful way of thinking about the relationship between action and legislation. So politicians didn't enact civil rights legislation until people took collective action, you know, in restaurants and in the streets, using their bodies collectively to disrupt the status quo. So all real change stems from disruption, from creating problems that those who have official power have to deal with. And so I think that labor is absolutely integral to that. And we have to do that, you know, at the work site, and we have to unionize more folks so that it's happening in more and more work sites, so that there's really, you know, a sort of fire taking place that gets ignited and spreads. And then when all these people are taking action and the officials are having to deal with all these fires and try to put them out over and over again, you know, that that's where we'll see change. And especially if that's uniting with things that are happening in the streets too, and people are voting, and all of these things are connected, and the officials in power are realizing that they've got fights on multiple fronts and that they simply can't contain this fire.
Wow. That sounds exciting. We packed this with so much stuff. This is a huge moment for labor. I think that means that it should be a huge moment also for DSA. We talked in this episode about the power of the working class and the power of the strike and the potential of the strike to move beyond bread and butter to political change and social justice in our communities, personal lives, and in the world. But we also tried in this conversation, I think, to be sober about what is possible given our forces and how organized we are. And that means that what we really need is socialists going out and organizing the labor movement. Hopefully in the series, you've picked up a little bit on what you can do, and we'll include in the description of these episodes how to get support if you want to organize your workplace, or if you'd like to volunteer with EWOC in supporting workers who are organizing new union drives, or if you're leading your chapter, you can sign up for NLC updates and stay tuned for strike support opportunities for your chapters. You can also reach out to EWOC because EWOC offers support for hosting local workplace organizing trainings, and we also support you in supporting new local organizing and union drives in your community. And I believe also, Ryan, that there is a new or in the process of being established labor corps. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that before we wrap up?
Yeah, absolutely. So like we said, it's going to be a busy year in 2023. And one thing that we're doing on the NLC is we want to ensure that we have open lines of communication for support and news and everything in between the national body and chapters. So we're building out the labor corps, which is something that we started to lay the groundwork for in 2022. And in 2023, we want to keep building that so that we do have an open line of communication between national and chapters. So that way, chapters know where to contact us, how to get support, what's going on, how they can support worker struggle, and vice versa. So that way, chapters can surface up to national what's happening in their area as far as labor struggle and how we can support.
Really appreciate you all taking the time. Appreciate Ryan and the NLC for co-hosting the series with the Political Education Committee. And Emma and Dawn for coming out and talking to us.
This is Class, an official podcast of the Democratic Socialists of America. National Political Education Committee. My name is Elton L.K. I'd like to thank Daphne Tier for pulling this episode together. Casey Sticker is a key member of our tiny team for sound engineering, theme music, and editing. And Palmer Conrad for additional help getting this podcast out. If you're a member of DSA, please share this podcast with your local chapter. Class is intended to be a resource for chapters and members to articulate, apply, and share socialist theory with DSA and the wider working class. Also, remember to rate and review us on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. As you know from listening to other podcasts, this is an important way to get out the word about class.